Greetings, friends. This is Dr. Mark Sharona, and I want to welcome you to The Edge podcast, where all things theological, psychological, spiritual, and cultural will be explored so that you and I might understand the times and know what to do about them. Enjoy. Friends, we're delighted today to have with us Dr. Joy Qualls, who is a professor at Biola. I'm delighted that she's able to be with us. She is an expert in rhetoric and in leadership, and she's a Pentecostal, which is always wonderful. I think it's interesting that she's at Biola with some voices that are there that are evangelicals, and so I think I'm grateful that God has a Pentecostal at Biola. There's probably a few others that I'm not aware of, but I'm certainly delighted that Dr. Joy is there. Dr. Joy, introduce yourself to our audience.
Well, thank you, Bishop. It is such a gift to be able to be with you. Like you said, my name is Joy Qualls. I am a California transplant. I grew up in North Dakota in the Pentecostal tradition. I'm a fourth generation Pentecostal, married to a fourth generation Pentecostal, raising a fifth generation of Pentecostals. So we proudly wear that moniker. I am at Biola University, what some might call the bastion of American fundamentalism. The actual fundamentals are in our archives here. So, and that story is nothing short of a miracle. But I am a rhetorician by trade, and have found a real home here, which is a wonderful thing for a scholar to have. My work is in the area of religious and political rhetoric and the intersections between the two. I didn't intend to become a gender scholar, but had the women of Pentecostalism walking with me and had to tell their stories. And so I'm probably best known in that realm, but it's actually just a minor part of the work that I do.
Wow. I'm working on a second doctorate right now at Birmingham, and the fourth chapter is on my spiritual mom, Violet Keitley from Oakland, California. She's gone home to be with the Lord now, but her impact in the latter rain was significant, and she never really got the credit she deserved because she was a woman, and she paid a high price like most women have in ministry. But so talk to me a little bit about your journey in rhetoric and in the intersection between religion and politics.
So I went to undergraduate school wanting to go into law. I came out of fairly extreme poverty in my upbringing in a single family home where my father, who was saved during the Jesus movement, had the wounds of Vietnam had been greater than the salvation of Jesus in his life, unfortunately, and he had walked away from our family. So I wanted to walk away from small town living and what I saw as the constraints, and college and a legal profession seemed the way to do that. My mom told me I could go anywhere in the country I wanted to go as long as I went to an Assemblies of God college because she could trust those things. So I found Vanguard, what is now Vanguard University, out here in Southern California. The only thing I was ever really good at was public speaking. And so I was convinced to study communication. And it was there that I fell in love with communication research and discovered the art of criticism from a scholarly perspective. And that led me to work at Regent University in Virginia Beach, Virginia, where I studied political communication. But my goal was still to make it to DC in some way, shape, or form. And so I interned several times in both the campaign and government world. And then after I finished my master's degree, found myself on Capitol Hill for 2 years, working in a position that was actually created for me. It wasn't an already established job. A senator I had worked for as an intern remembered me and wanted to experiment with a new role. And so I took that job. It was hard to make up a job from scratch when you're 26 years old and don't really know what you're doing. But it was a really great experience. But it was there that God distinctly spoke to me for the first time in my life and said, you know, I've given you everything you asked for and you can have it. It is a gift. Are you willing to walk away from all of this and do what it is I want you to do? And so I'm probably the only person who left the United States Senate to become a church secretary. But that's what I did, trying to figure out what it was that God wanted me to do next, and opened the door for me to go back to Regent and do a PhD, where who I was as a Christian and who I believed we were to be in the political sphere came to land together. So that's where the intersections started to come from. And as they say, the rest is sort of history.
So who was at Regent when you were there? I mean, who were the department heads when you were there?
Yeah, so Bob Scheel was my original dissertation director, my favorite Catholic in the whole wide world. And he led most of my master's program. Doug Tarpley also managed part of my master's program because he was in the journalism program in DC at the time. Ben Frazier would eventually sit on my committee. Bill Brown taught me statistics and I'm still not good at those things, but he tried. And then a gentleman named Mark Steiner came in while I was in the middle of my PhD program, another rhetorician, and he took over my work on my dissertation. And he's of the Reformed tradition. So we had very interesting ideas about the role of women in the church, but always a champion of mine.
Wow. Was I'm assuming Vincent Sinan was still there back in those days.
Yes. So I was in the comm school, but I had to do an intensive in the theology school with Dr. Sinan so that I could get my Pentecostal history correct.
Yeah.
That
would have been quite the experience. Because I mean, back in those days, I mean, Vincent certainly was a pioneer in terms of Pentecostal theology. And certainly we owe a great debt to him for the work he did. And the fact that back then, I mean, obviously Pat Robertson recognized the significance of Vincent's work. And what administration did you serve under when you worked for the senator?
So I was there, actually did my interview in October of 2001. So it was right as September 11th was occurring. Yeah. So the first Bush administration. I did leadership change in the Senate during that time. So at one point we were out of leadership, another point we were in leadership. It was an interesting time and an interesting experience, that's for sure.
So talk to me about, obviously you're groomed and prepared for the world beyond the Beltway. Mm-hmm. I've been there many times, and I've been at the White House there and with the Senate, with caucuses of pastors and leaders, mostly within the African-American community, in three administrations. Life inside the Beltway is quite different than life outside the Beltway. Talk to me about your own cognitions and perceptions about life inside the Beltway.
Sure. It's still my favorite city in the world. I love Washington, D.C. so much. There is an energy and a intensity there that never left me. I actually lived in a scary little apartment right off of Capitol Hill on the House side. It's a much nicer neighborhood today than it was when I lived there. But it certainly is a bubble, much like our Christian colleges can become a bit of a bubble for students who live there. The outside world doesn't get as much attention. Those who live there don't go home often enough to touch base with all of those other places. Again, much like our students don't go home very often to touch base with those spaces. So you kind of end up in a space where you forget that the rest of the world is not paying as much attention to what is happening there as what's happening in their own lives. And I think even as a scholar, it's a temptation for me to forget that not everybody pays as close of attention to the things that I pay attention to. And so when I have conversations with friends or family, you know, they may not only might we not see things the same way, but they've not been reading and immersing themselves in the debate and the text of bills and things of that nature. And so it's very easy to get caught up. And I think that's what happens, is that it's very insular. DC's a small town. It's not a big place. And I think that's one of the big challenges, is that it's not just coastal elite. It is its own encompassed.
Oh, yeah. I love DC. I mean, I really love DC. I'm there often, and we've got friends that have churches in that area, but it's a great area. There's a lot to be said for that. Talk to me a little bit about, if it's insular, then the outsider's perception of what goes on in DC as opposed to the insider's perception. What, shed some light on that for our listeners.
So I think our outsider's perception is that they don't care what's going on in the outside world. That was not my experience. Again, I worked for a senator from my home state in North Dakota, where at that time, the line between Democrats and Republicans from North Dakota was a very thin line. Socially and religiously, you probably wouldn't have found much difference. The latest oil boom had not sort of begun to consume the state. So there wasn't sort of some of this shift from sort of the agricultural politics to the industrial politics that has sort of taken place over the last few years, which again, I don't necessarily think is right or wrong. It's just shift that has occurred. But I think that the perception is that they go to Washington and they forget. They forget what it means to be at home. They forget what it's like to be at home. And I get it, it's tough if you are a staffer or an elected official, and you've got kids and a family. You're raising them in Northern Virginia or Maryland or right there in the district. You're not living back and forth, except for perhaps more members on the House side. Like, that's on the House side, you tend to have elected officials who keep apartments, or they, you know, live together in townhouses, or they sleep on their sofas as some sort of way to make themselves real human beings. But their families are back home. So there's a little bit, I shouldn't overgeneralize in that way. But I think the perception from home is that people go there and they forget what home is like. And those charges were leveled even, you know, 25 years ago.
And probably before that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I don't think the founders ever envisioned DC being a place of settlement. You know? it was a swamp and, yeah. You know, not the most hospitable place during those days. But yet at the same time, like I could not have imagined working there and having to divide my living. I traveled back and forth as part of my role, but I understand the perception challenges. Let me put it that way.
So, and given that, you know, right now, I mean, obviously the social media wars are rife, and the level of civility has declined in the last number of years. But I think there's a perception, maybe you can speak, there is this perception that things are getting worse. And what little I know about history, I'm not a historian, but I've had to study it for many reasons in what I do with theology. Americans have always been, on both sides of the aisle, pretty outspoken, pretty polemical, pretty intense. Maybe comment a little bit on that, just to put that in perspective.
I think our awareness makes us believe that things are getting worse, but we have not, as of recent history, had anybody arrested on the floor of the House. That's happened before. We are not taking up arms against one another. I hope we don't come to that again in our history. So I think this idea that things are getting worse is a misnomer, in that we have gone through cycles of hostility in our politics, much more dramatic. I mean, listen, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr out on the Hill, right? I mean, we're not seeing those kind of things take place today. And so I think that's where we have to take the energy down a notch. I do think we're farther apart in our politics because, so this is where the rhetorician in me comes in. I think the way we use language has created a division that we are no longer loyal opposition to one another. We are one another's enemies. And so it's not that I just disagree with my political counterpart. They are literally trying to destroy America. And that language occurs on both sides and amongst independents, right? So it's this idea that you are my enemy. And I think as a Christian, the problem with that language is, even if it were true, even if you as my political opposition are in fact my enemy, Jesus has commanded us how to deal with our enemies. And so we're not in the same place. We must treat our enemies as if they are beloved and cherished by the God of the universe, because they are, and we are to show them hospitality, and we are to care about them, and we are to listen, and all the ways that we show love. And I think that is where the church is falling prey to the temptations of the world in this season, is that we have taken up the language, we've taken up that rhetoric of enemy hate instead of radical enemy love. And I think it's destroying us. It's not going to destroy them, but it's destroying us.
Yeah, we've militarized the cross. We have weaponized the gospel. We have created an us and them. It deeply grieves me. It just deeply grieves me. Rhetoric. Now, my study of rhetoric comes out of my study of psycholinguistics, which was part of my psychological training. And also, I was very immersed in the work of the guys that created NLP, Richard Bandler and John Grinder back in the Berkeley days. I was, their whiz kids were, I was fascinated by that. I got certified and trained in all that, but we did have to study linguistics and rhetoric and obviously look at all of that. Talk to me a little bit about, because what you basically are saying is that words, like Rabbi Heschel, words create worlds, and words have emotional impact. So what has rhetoric taught you about the human psyche and our interpersonal relationships?
So I take the definition of rhetoric as this: it's the human use of symbols to induce a response in other human beings. So that's not limited to persuasion in the way that we tend to think about persuasion. I think rhetoric is a means of inquiry and questioning as much as it is about interpersonal engagement. But I do also ascribe to the idea that words don't mean, people mean. And so out of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so the language that we use, the way that we speak about things, the choices that we make in the way that we talk about the world around us does exactly as you describe from Rabbi Heschel, that our reality is constructed by virtue of our social relationships and the engagement that we have with them. It is one of the reasons why you're seeing such a stark divide today, because of the ways that media and the media choices. I'm not an anti. I don't like the descriptions of the media as some entity out there. We are all media. If you have a Facebook account, yeah, you are a member of the media. Congratulations. But the way that we take in the messages that we're hearing, the people that we surround ourselves with, our reality is constructed. Our understanding of the way the world works is constructed in those spaces. And that's where we have divided ourselves. If I'm a conservative, I only listen to these sources. If I'm a liberal, I only listen to these sources. And if I want to sound incredibly enlightened, I will read many sources, right? But the reality is that we are, by virtue of algorithms and the choices that we're making. So I also don't want to relieve us of responsibility in this space, but in with the algorithms and the choices that we're making, we literally are living in different worlds from our neighbors.
Yeah, we are. And
that is problematic. That's when you don't share realities with one another. Again, the ability to make the other an other is a very dangerous proposition.
And given your awareness of those realities and the trends they're creating, put on your forecasting perceptual lens. Tell me where this ends up from what you see there.
I'm afraid of where it ends, to be honest with you.
I am too, but go ahead and just share. I think it's important.
I do think that we could be heading towards greater acts of violence. I don't know that it will be exactly as civil war as we have understood civil war in our history, but I think like the storming of the Capitol, I think things like protests that get out of control. Again, no matter how righteous you view those actions, the fact that we have chosen physical violence over sitting down around the table together, that right. sacred space, that's what concerns me. What concerns me is that greater acts of violence will become the ways that people who are more prone to reactionary choices will believe that they are engaged in a holy war, in a righteous act,
jihad of sorts.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think we are wrong to not look at the way religious fervor, both historically in Christianity and outside of Christianity, gives us an example of these things. You know, and we like to say, well, that's only them over there in those religions and in those spaces. No, we're seeing it. If you look at the images from the Capitol on January 6th, people are carrying crosses and flags that say Jesus saves. There was a religious fervor to that action that scholars like me just can't ignore. We just can't ignore it.
Yeah, I can't either. And it's deeply disconcerting. You know, my first doctorate was with Len Sweet in applied semiotics and future leadership studies. So I look at trends and trajectories. I mean, if we're going to understand the times and know what to do, we've got to come to terms with this. When you, obviously, I mean, college and university has changed, but what's the average age of the students you are dealing with right now? And because that leads to my next question in light of what we're talking about.
So my world is still mostly made up of traditional 18 to 22 year old young people. We are venturing out into non-traditional programs. I'm in the process of leading the development of a non-traditional program, which would appeal to both what we would call working adults, people beyond that 18 to 22 year old realm, but also those in that traditional age realm who perhaps cannot afford a traditional college education, or who already work full-time and need to do school sort of on their own terms. So we're a little late to the game in my world in what we might call online education, but we are crafting programs in what I would say are not exactly what has been happening, but trying to point to what could be the next thing. I think the pandemic and remote education has opened up the door that we could actually do learning like you and I are having this conversation now, as opposed to just asynchronous on your own education. But I would say that's still stirring and formulating. So I'm still very much in the traditional population right now.
Okay, so I'm a late baby boomer. I'm 67. You would be a millennial.
I'm an Xer, actually.
You're an Xer. Okay. All right. So you're an Xer, and you're dealing with Gen Zers.
Yes, that's right.
Talk to me about, in light of everything we've been talking about, what do you see in terms of their consciousness that both encourages you and concerns you based on what we're talking about.
Yeah. So I was born in 1976. That'll give you an idea of where I am. So I am an Xer, but I've spent most of my life among millennials. So I probably, you're okay. Probably not wrong to think that I think like a millennial in some ways. Where I would say, so let me just go through the three generations that I inhabit. Xers are the lost generation who are holding up the sky right now. Let me just say that. While baby boomers and millennials fight it out for the power structures, we're the ones doing the work, and we're tired. So that's number one. Number two, I think early millennials, 86, early 80s, to late 80s millennials could have cared less about politics. They may even have voted, but they just weren't. In fact, I saw universities begin to drop classes in political engagement because students weren't interested in taking them. Later millennials and Zs are much more interested. They're not convinced politics in our traditional form are the way to solve things, but they are very socially aware. They are justice minded. They have this deep sense of wanting to reconcile the world. Even those who don't know Jesus have this, this spirit about them, this sense about them that things in the world are not right and it's our generation's job to fix it. But even amongst my Christian students, I see a desire amongst them to want to fix and change things. The challenge that they encounter right now is we have moved from the helicopter parent, those were the parents that kind of hovered around their children, to the steamroller parent who attempts to move every obstacle out of their child's way. So one of the great challenges of this generation, while their minds and their hearts are justice oriented, they have been cut off at the knees because they've never been allowed by their parents to have to fight for anything, to wrestle
with what it takes. Yeah.
That's exactly right. So they've never wrestled intellectually. They've never wrestled physically, that everything has been cleared out of their way. And I have never spoken to more parents than I have in the last 10 years who are just, you know, I need to talk to you about my child and their education. I need to find out what's going on. The pandemic was a bit of a nightmare because parents were wanting to sit in on classes that they had zero context for, or chapel services that they would, you know, dive into or dive out of. And then all of a sudden they wanted to be a part of that. You know, I want to speak into what chapel is. I want to talk about, I want a parents group. We have parent relations offices. I don't remember if there was a parent relations office at my university in undergrad. If there was, my mother was not involved in it. And if I had called her and said, I'm having trouble with this professor, she would have said, go talk to them and deal with it. After she probably would have said, what did you do? You know, would have been hers. But that's the difference. The difference is that these students want to engage. They long to be a part of great change movements. They see themselves with grand visions, but they are utterly paralyzed. And it's my generation that paralyzed them, because we are the parents. We are the ones. I mean, my children are younger, but I started late. But as I'm seeing, you know, my friends who have raised children, who are now college age, you know, they're so much more involved with their kids. And I have to tell you, I tell my kids all the time, I'm so sorry. Most of my parenting comes as a reaction to the students that I have today and the way that they weren't parented, because I want my kids to have the tools and the resources. I really want them to have the faith tradition to be able to do battle, not against flesh and blood, but against those principalities and powers.
Do you see then within those parents that are many of them or are a group of them now wrestling in crisis mode with how to course correct? Is that becoming part of their consciousness? Or
I don't know about correction. I think okay. What they're wrestling with is this deep-seated fear And I think that that's, it's playing out in so many aspects of our, that's what I hear when I talk to even my own contemporaries. I'm so afraid of the world that my children are inhabiting. I'm so afraid that the world is not the world that we were promised. You know, I'm so afraid. And it's easy to fall into that trap. I mean, listen, I live in Southern California. I couldn't buy a home if I wanted to. Gas prices are a dollar more here than they are in the rest of the country. This is a hard place to live. So I understand those fears. What challenges me is that why are we not talking more in our churches about the fact that we have been commanded not to fear? We have been created for this time. God is not caught off guard by the moment that we are living in. He's not worried about the children who are coming into this world. He has created them for this moment. They have been made for this place. I mean, I'm just enough of an Xer that I was told over and over again that we were going to change the world, and we believed them. And so I still am of that mind that, like, this is our moment, and this is the moment for the church to shine and not shrink back. But I think what the pandemic and some of the economic insecurity has done is it's not caused any of these things, but it has rolled back the cover.
It's revealed what's there.
And the truth of the matter is, and it's easy for me to fall into this trap too, so I'm not casting blame, but our God is a political figure. He is not the God of the universe. We have worshiped idols for far too long, and we have not discipled our people to trust the Lord with all their hearts, minds, and souls, but instead to believe that we can sit in two spaces, that we can both be the power figures in the culture, but also the embattled minority. And for whatever reason, we don't see the cognitive dissonance that causes. But those are the two messages. We must both be in power, but by the way, we're also the persecuted minority. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, and I mentioned this to you before the podcast, but I wrestle with the term evangelical. Now, I know we can make broad generalizations that actually are cognitive distortions about the evangelicals in America, because we're not a monolithic group. I have however, as a bishop of pastors and as a pastor of a church, I've done my best to share with our people that I've shied away in the last few years from the term evangelical, because it tends to lean towards what is being emphasized as a very militant, triumphal, weaponized cross message. And as a Pentecostal, and I'm unashamedly Pentecostal because of my concern for the marginalized. That for me, if I want to know where Jesus is, he's not in the middle of where the power is. He's out on the periphery where the leftovers are, the disenfranchised, the marginalized. Talk to me a little bit as a Gen Xer who was raised in Pentecost for generations. Who are the figures for you that have inspired you in the Pentecostal tradition?
Oh, well, my hero is a friend of yours. Cheryl Bridges Johns very much the mother. she's my mothership in so many ways.
That's wonderful.
Inspired my work. But I would also say so many of the women that I have studied in Pentecost, there's a wonderful woman from the turn of the last century, just after, World War II era. Sorry, I made her older than she would have been. But she was an evangelist named May Eleanor Fry. So she was in 1930s, and when women were not credentialed in the Assemblies of God, and then 86 years of life of evangelistic ministry. But she took on the KKK in Mississippi. She challenged mob bosses in Chicago. She stood on the floor of district councils and gave these grand orations. But at the end of the day, like, she just wanted people to know Jesus. And so every year she would send in her $5 and she would write a letter to the General Council of the Assemblies of God and just ask them to give her a credential, and they never would. And they would write back. They would keep her $5, by the way, but they would, write back. But towards the end of her life, she was granted an evangelist's license. So she was eventually credentialed. But women like her were, I think, you had no cultural, you had no social power. Feminism was not a word we would have used. Women had maybe achieved the vote by the time they came along, depending on which woman you're talking about. But that they acted on such authority, that they traveled around the world, that they traveled around the country, and they just believed that God would provide for them. And so women like Cheryl, who to me operate in those gifts, Kim Alexander is another one who despite just incredible challenge, continues to forge ahead in the work that she does. I too wrestle with the word of evangelical, because I live in a space that is, I too am unabashedly Pentecostal. I use that language. God has placed me here in this more evangelical fundamentalist space. And I will say it a million times, Biola has been very good to me. And God has placed me in this space and shown me favor in this space, where perhaps in other generations that would not have been the case. But God is at work here. And I believe in what Biola is doing. But the word evangelical, if you look at the latest Pew data that has come out on their work in religion and American public life, the people self-identifying as evangelicals has actually gone up in the Trump years. While church involvement, things like that, have gone down, self-identified evangelicals have gone up. But if you dig into that data, there's some very interesting revelations. So church attendance is still going down, and these folks are not attending church. The averages of church attendance are less than once a year. Now, I'm not quite sure how that works, but statistically, less than once a year. They have no biblical literacy whatsoever. They can't answer basic biblical texts. So the term evangelical has become co-opted because it is an identifier of political affiliation, not religious affiliation. And so as much as I would love to fight for the term to say it is really about, you know, Bebbington's quadrilateral or something of that nature, it is not what most would recognize it as. And so I use it in a scattered way. I use it when I need to, but it's not how I would identify my own religious conviction, because I want people to know that my conviction is, as you said, it is not in the power structures of this world. I learned really quickly as a child of the 80s who walked the halls of and the tunnels of the Capitol. We were not going to change American politics because we took it over. If anything, we were there to be salt and light amongst the darkness, but not so that we could gain some position of power or authority, but that we could advocate on behalf of those who were not in those power spheres. I think the greatest challenge to Pentecostalism is that we fought so hard to be accepted by mainstream evangelicals, and we've lost our way. Because we are the kids from the other side of the tracks. We are the people of color and the poor and the women and the children. But that is who God moved upon. And when he moved again, we just did a conference on the Jesus People movement here at Biola. And I was so overcome by the study of that era, that when Jesus moved again, he moved again amongst the drug addict and the Vietnam veteran.
Lonnie Frisbee and all those guys. Yeah. Out on the point in Irvine.
Yeah.
Smith baptized with him, all those kids.
That's exactly right. You know, so one, I say this to everybody who's written off California, be careful, because the Spirit of God has a heart for California, and the Spirit has moved here twice. And don't put it past the Spirit to move here again. But that I also just think that when we historically look at these moves of God, they're not in the halls of power.
Yeah, and I think there's want to be careful how I say this, but I think there has come within Pentecostal circles, we have become enamored with a false notion of what the power of God is all about. We've equated what we see as power in relationship to government. And I know the roots of this theologically and historically because of the work I have had to do, but I don't think they are. I listen to great men and women of God that I love dearly, but I realize they're not as astute in their own history as they claim to be. And because of that, the trajectory they're moving on is deeply concerning for me. It's just deeply concerning. I can tell you this much, Dr. Joy. I was a fan at a distance, but you have now sold me. I think you need to be heard like in millions of places all around the world. Like, we need to figure out how to promote you so that your voice can be heard everywhere. I think it's wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about rhetoric in terms of how do we speak truth to power in a culture where there is, within the church, this addiction to a false notion of power, because we are called to speak truth to power. How do we do that faithfully?
So I think there's a couple of ways that we do this. One, we have to return to radical discipleship. We have lost, and I'm not saying like we must have Sunday school in the way that we used to have Sunday school, and we must do, you know, but even trying to find opportunities for my own children to have intense Christian discipleship, it's hard to find those spaces. We're a small church plant, which I love being so I think the other side of that coin is that I think the parish movement, where we are sort of moving away from the mega church model, seeing how destructive that model has been to create sort of these megalomaniac leaders and these toxic power environments, that the parish movement amongst small church plants that continue to highlight that the truth of the matter is in Pentecostalism and in greater evangelicalism, the average church size in America is 250. Most 250 people, yeah, right. But that there's power in those spaces, because in those small churches, there are opportunities to serve. In those spaces, there are ways in which to have these deep level conversations. It's why I appreciate the church that we belong to. It also means that the resources are not necessarily there for some of these other things. And so so we have to find a way to return to discipleship. We have got to get people back into studying the scripture in a way that we understand who Jesus was and the work that he did. We have to tell the truth about the scripture. You know, I mean, I recently had opportunity to watch a Bible engagement something or another. I'm going to get the title wrong, so I don't want to call it what it was, because I don't want to say the wrong thing. But a biblical literacy curriculum, where the opening video talked about John 1:1 as the Word being the Bible.
Oh gosh!
And I was like, No, we can't even get John 1:1 right.
Then it's
not biblical literacy curriculum. That is
exegetical fallacy.
Dangerous. Like, you know, that's not it. And so if we don't even know our Bible, we can't share our Bible with others. And so I think until we are willing to say, we have to back away from attempting to be the lobbyists in Washington, D.C., that we have to decide that our job is not to be at our state capitals, you know, protesting. Our job is to be teaching people the scripture. Our job is to be gathering together in prayer meetings. Our job is to be holding blood drives and food drives and things of that nature in our churches. And again, that doesn't mean we're not involved in those processes. My niece is a staffer on Capitol Hill, and I believe she is there by the call of God. And I pray that her influence would be in those spaces, not as somebody to lobby on behalf of a cause, but as somebody, again, bringing light into dark spaces with the people that she encounters. So I'm not opposed to working in those spaces, but I think the idea that we're to be there with access to the Oval is a counter to the power that would come from Bible study and prayer and serving our communities right where we're at.